calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And top of the Monday to you. Greetings. Happy Monday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be joined by Mark Crispin Miller at the bottom of the hour, and he'll be taking your calls as well. His new book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election, How They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them, is now out. And is it even possible? That somehow, I mean, I'm just amazed. Somebody actually has come out with a book and said, yep, sure enough, they stole that sucker. They stole the 2004 election. And John Kerry actually agreed with him about it at one point. So anyhow, Bill O'Reilly back on the defensive for comments advocating a terrorist attack on a U.S. city. Francis Moore LaPay is here with a new book, Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life. It explains what we can do to revive our democracy. And you'll get your week in review in the third hour of our program with the best of the rest of the news, just sort of looking at what's happened and what's coming up. We'll bring in a couple of experts on the news, people in the media, and what are their thoughts about what's going on. Our theme for the day, democracy through peace, has been the goal of America for centuries. Why have we allowed a single man, George W. Bush, and a single party, the Republicans, to destroy our reputation worldwide? Our quote for the day from John Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. The website, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into the live chat room and say hi. In Action 2005 in our chat room says, John Kerry's a chicken. Wait until you hear the story that Mark Crispin Miller has to tell about his conversation with John Kerry. I think you'll find it very interesting. Over the weekend, we were treated to the great right-wing spin machine. And boy, are they! Trying to reinvent history. It was just amazing to hear. Here you've got on Veterans Day. Traditionally, on Veterans Day, the president goes to Arlington Memorial Cemetery and lays a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers. I frankly don't know how far back this tradition goes, but it goes back a long, long way. And George Bush decided that he wasn't going to do that. Instead, and Veterans Day is the day that, you know, we honor our fallen soldiers. Veterans Day, of course, last Friday. Veterans Day, the day that we honor our fallen soldiers and say, you know, this is about being here for the soldiers. And Bush instead used a Veterans Day speech to pick on Democrats. In other words, a partisan speech. This is a tragedy. I mean, this is embarrassing. So anyhow, what it started was this whole argument now about, well, didn't the Democrats, they all voted for this, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, a few bits of information that you may not know. Ken Mellman, for example, the head of the Republican National Committee, on the talk shows over the weekend, saying, well, you had more than 80 Democrats in Congress voting for this, a majority of them in the Senate. Majority of the Democrats in the Senate, over 80 members in Congress. The fact of the matter is, while the majority of Democrats in the Senate, barely, a majority of Democrats in the Senate voted for the war, a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against the war. Number one. So you've got Bush running around and Mellman and all these other, McCain, Roberts, everybody else. Oh, the Democrats all thought that this was, you know, everybody else saw the same intelligence. They all thought we shouldn't go. The majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against this. Number one. Number two, they're coming out and they're saying, well, the whole world saw the same intelligence. They all thought that, you know, it was a terrible thing. We ought to go to war. Actually, let me go back to number one, first of all. As I was surprised to hear, frankly, Tim Russert bring up on Meet the Press over the weekend, The intelligence services of the United States are part of the executive branch, not the legislative branch. Remember, we have three branches of government. They don't work for the Supreme Court. They don't work for Congress. They work for the president. And so to say that the president, and they provide daily briefings to the president, and the president has access to all kinds of inside information, and in obviously in this case, with the WIG group, W-H-I-G, the White House Iraq group, set up out of running out of Dick Cheney's office, with the Office of Special Plans set up at the Pentagon, running out of Rumsfeld's office, both of these in the executive branch, cherry-picking intelligence. You've got the Downing Street memo saying back in June before the invasion that this administration was, you know, definite. We're gonna go out and we're gonna fix the intelligence to the policy. To say that Congress saw the same information that the White House did is not just disingenuous. It's a flat out lie. The executive branch had access to all of the intelligence, including intelligence that, for example, Curveball, you know, the related to Shalabee, Shalabee's little informer, was an unreliable alcoholic who had given phony information in the past in a number of situations, and nobody took him seriously. To begin with, the Shalabee who was providing us with information, we were paying this guy $300,000 a month for information. We paid him a total of, I believe, as I recall, $14 million. The Shalabee was convicted of bank swindling, bank robbery, not robbery, a bank fraud in Jordan. He's facing a 23, 24, 27 years, 20 plus year of hard labor in Jordan. And he's strutting around Washington, D.C. as we speak. Shalabee, whose father was one of the richest men in Iraq, Saddam Hussein sort of removed him from that position, got him out of Iraq. Shalabee trying to get back to being one of the richest men in Iraq. Right now he's in charge of all the oil. By the way, the actor who played Billy Jack, he's got a website. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't give it to you, but you can easily Google it. It might just be BillyJack.com. I'm not sure. He's got on his website the solution to the problem in Iraq. He says simply give the oil back to Iraq so that they can honor the contracts that they had. France had contracts with them, Russia had contracts with them, China had contracts with them. And those people will send their people in to protect the oil fields and we can get out. Very simple. But anyhow, the second big lie that the Bush administration was telling, the first being, you know, well, the Democrats knew everything. The second being, well, the French, the Germans, the Russians, the Chinese, they all saw the same intelligence. Well, actually, they had their own intelligence as well. But let's hear what they actually said. On March 17th of 03, before the war, before the invasion of Iraq, Jacques Chirac, the president of France, quote, "France is not pacifist. We are not anti-American either. We are not just going to use our veto to nag and annoy the U.S. But we just feel that there is another option, another way, a less dramatic way than war. And that we have to go down that path. And we should pursue it until we have come to a dead end, but that is not the case yet." Remember Hans Blix telling us that, well, yeah, you know, they used to believe in witches too, these guys who believe in WMD, but I'd like to see the evidence. This was at the end, this was after his investigations, after he was pulled out by Bush.
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But he didn't have that. And Jacques Chirac saying the same thing. Germany, Foreign Minister Joachim Fischer. The Security Council is now meeting for the third time within a month at a ministerial level to discuss the Iraq crisis. Are we really in a situation that absolutely necessitates the ultimate ratio or the very last resort? I think not, because the peaceful means are far from exhausted. Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, it is our deep this is March 7th, 03. Again, these quotes are from March 7th, 03. Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, it is our deep conviction that the possibilities for disarming Iraq through political means do exist, and they really exist. And this cannot but be acknowledged. China's foreign minister, Tang Jianghong, on the 7th of March, 03. We believe that as long as we stick to the road of political settlement, the goal of destroying Iraq's WMD can still be obtained. Given the current situation, we need resolve and determination, and more importantly, patience and wisdom. Patience and wisdom. Keep in mind, the Security Council was still investigating Iraq's weapons of mass destruction when George W. Bush preemptively, without a vote of the Security Council authorizing it, preemptively decided that he was going to attack. So that's it. We're coming to get you. Amazing. And then he said, and don't destroy your oil wells, by the way. Remember that? 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 and a half minutes past the hour.
Yes, we want it all. We want the House. We want the Senate. We'd like to have the Supreme Court back.
How about democracy? That would be a nice start. I think it would be a very healthy start, as a matter of fact. Think Progress has a great summary of Bush defending his manipulation of intelligence. And, you know, today, well, this was over the weekend, President Bush attempted to defend his manipulation of pre-war intelligence by citing the Senate Intelligence Committee report. And I've been finding all these cons on the talk shows. They're all saying, oh, the Senate Intelligence Committee. Bush says, these critics are fully aware that a bipartisan Senate intelligence investigation found no evidence of political pressure to change the intelligence community's judgments related to Iraq's weapons programs. Nonsense! The reality is that the part of the committee's investigation that would have determined whether there was political pressure hasn't been done yet! What the Senate Intelligence Committee did report, however, was that there's plenty of evidence demonstrating that the intelligence assessments made by intel officials were changed. As the LA Times reported in July of 04, the unclassified version of the National Intelligence Estimate, the so-called white paper cited by the Bush administration making its case for war, those carefully classified conclusions in the classified version were turned into blunt assertions of fact. In other words, the actual intelligence information said, well, maybe this, maybe that, possibly this. And Bush says, no, this is it. This is the way it is. Amazing. 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. George in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, George, how you doing? Thanks for listening to KBBR. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I thank you for bringing up this subject, because anybody that was paying the slightest bit of attention knew that Bush was tweaking the evidence and lying about it long before the war. But what I really wanted to talk about is, speaking of the LA Times, they on Veterans Day, they fired Robert Scheer, who I wasn't real familiar with, but he was a 30-year veteran of the LA Times. He was a columnist that was a little bit left-leaning, I suppose, and they have a new publisher, Jeff Johnson, who is a total Bush stooge. So I don't know that if you were aware of that. I heard about it on
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've gotten several emails from folks who are, you know, let's go down and protest at the L.A. Times building and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Frankly, you know, I don't know whether that's going to work or not. Robert Scheer's a good guy. He's a brilliant journalist. He's well-known. He's got a good following. I suspect he'll land on his feet. I think it's a tragedy for the L.A. Times.
Oh, it's a tragedy for the world. It's a tragedy for the U.S. because we're getting fewer and fewer outlets for the truth about what a bunch of lying crooks these people are.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thank you for letting me vent.
You're welcome, George. You're always welcome to vent on our program. Thanks for the call and thanks for listening to the program. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to pass some information along to you. First of all, I'd like to say the Republicans, I think, are for the rich, and the Democrats are for the people.
Well, by and large, that's been the case ever since 1874, when the railroads basically bribed their way into the Republican Party. You know, remember, the Republican Party started in 1856, actually, as the Reform Party, because the Democrats had become so corrupt.
Hello?
Yeah, you still there? Jeff? Jeff? Well, he's there on the board. Okay, Jeff, if you can't hear me, it's something wrong with your phone. I'm just gonna drop you and thank you for your comment and give you my rant. The Republicans started in 1856 as the Reform Party, and in Jackson, Michigan, and their first presidential candidate, of course, Abe Lincoln. But after the Civil War, in the platform, by the way, the Republican platform of 1872, which you can find if you go to tomhartmann.com and click on Articles on Democracy. There's an article I wrote called Republicans Take Your Party Back. Very progressive party in 1872. But, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years, they got totally bought out by the railroads, and they have been the party of, you know, they have been the reincarnation, essentially, of the Federalist Party, which Jefferson referred to as the party of the rich and the well-born ever since. And Americans, oddly enough, this generation of Americans are just now realizing this. Because for the first time in the, you know, 150 years history of the Republican Party, for the first time since Reagan, they've essentially been lying about what they're all about. They've figured out all these little phrases like, you know, responsible government and small government and things like that to cover up what they used to say, which was Social Security is communism. We can't have it. Mickey in San Luis Obispo, California. I'm sure I mispronounced it. Hey, Mickey, we got less than a minute here. You wanted to make a quick comment?
Yeah, I do.
Go for it.
Yeah, I just want people to realize that this Thursday is the Great American Smokeout, where everybody in the U.S. that smokes is encouraged to quit smoking at least for one day.
Yeah.
Kick the habit for good.
Yes, and a fine thing it would be.
Yeah, and we actually manufacture playing cards for tobacco education. We were featured on CNN Headline News last year. We're health department, schools, clinics, the military's using them.
That's great. You got a website you want to plug, Mickey?
Yeah, deathcards.com. Death like you're no longer alive and cards with an S. Deathcards.com.
Right, yeah.
And it's a great educational tool designed to get the attention of youth.
That sounds great. That's what we need.
Check them out.
Yeah, because thanks a lot, Mickey. Yeah, this is the big challenge. I mean, we face this raising three kids ourselves. How do you raise a teenager in the face of a multi-billion dollar effort by the tobacco companies to convince them that they should be taking an addictive drug? It's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. And so, deathcards.com. Great. Every little bit helps. Mark Crispin Miller is coming up. He's going to be here in the studio with us. He's got a new book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and How They'll Steal the Next One, Too. And he'll take your calls as well. 1-866-440-THOM. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
I know a place. Ain't nobody crying.
And welcome back, my friends.
Ain't nobody worried.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Ain't no smiling faces.
If only the voting machines would actually tell us what we voted for, then maybe we could have a place where everybody's smiling. Yeah, but unfortunately, that ain't the case right now. Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-M-A-C-S, smalldog.com for the latest in iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer for that matter. Mark Crispin Miller is here with me, and right here in the studio, he's doing a book tour right now for his new book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Elections and How They'll Steal the Next One, Too. Hey, Mark.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you. Great to have you here.
Listen, you left off the parenthetical ending of the title, which is the hopeful part.
Unless we stop them.
Unless we stop them.
Yeah.
They're not going to do it if we stop them.
You're right. It's in a different color here. So.
I know. That's the only problem with the cover, which I think is great.
Yeah. No, it's marvelous. Actually, I had my hand over it because I was whacking the thing and said, this is such a great book, you know.
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, so let's see. You had a conversation with John Kerry recently.
Yes, I did.
What happened?
A couple of weeks ago, I got myself invited to a fundraiser of his political action committee in New York because I wanted to give him a copy of Fooled Again.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the book to kickstart a movement of national election reform, which we desperately need. Because if we don't do this as soon as possible, the whole experiment is finished.
The American experiment.
The American experiment, exactly. And so I got myself invited to this fundraiser to give Kerry a copy of the book and try to... Well, I said to him, Senator, you were robbed. And he said, I know, just like that, put his hands to his head. I know.
Yeah.
and then started to lament the fact that none of his colleagues on the Hill will discuss this with him. He told me that he'd had a big argument recently with Christopher Dodd of Connecticut. He tried to tell Dodd, you know, these machines, these voting machines are very iffy. There's this wrong with them. There's that wrong with them.
Yeah.
Dodd got mad and said, we looked into it. There's no story there. He didn't want to hear about it. His point was, you know, I sure hope there's solid evidence in your book because, you know, we need evidence.
Yeah.
I said there's plenty of evidence in the book, and I mentioned the Government Accountability Office report on the voting machines.
Yeah, the GAO report.
The GAO report. Interestingly, Kerry hadn't heard of it.
You're kidding.
No.
Congress commissions a report which says that the voting machines are not safe and secure. They deliver it to Congress, and a member of Congress is unaware of it?
Yes. And I bit my tongue and did not say, what is your staff in a coma?
Yeah. You
know, why do I know this and you don't? But he was. The upside of this is that he was clearly very impressed that the GAO had done this, and he wanted to get a hold of a copy.
Yeah.
He said, so I said to him, Senator, you know, in the spirit of your groundbreaking investigations of Iran-Contra and BCCI, you know, which I actually do believe was the high point of his Senate
career. Oh, and it was amazing what he uncovered with BCCI.
Great.
It nearly brought down Bush Sr.
Exactly.
I mean, it had the potential to do that.
Right. So, you know, I was playing to his strengths, and I said, if you, you know, would look into the election and come up with some, you know, solid stuff about the state of our electoral system, you'd be doing the country more than a favor. And I hinted that it would also help him with the people he's alienated with his concession.
You know? Right.
And he said, well, I don't know if I can be the one to lead that kind of investigation because of the sour grapes factor.
Sure.
I said,
which is very real. In
and I understand that.
Yeah.
I said, I understand.
I mean, look at what they did to the guy, the governor of, was it Alabama, the Democrat, who won and then he went to sleep. And then the next morning, the voting machines found, what, I think it was 11,000 more votes. And suddenly the Republican was in charge.
That's right.
And all the talk show hosts just beat the bejesus out of this guy
in this
state, calling him a sour grapes loser. And he ended up rolling over without even demanding a recount.
Yeah, and I'm sympathetic to that. I understand that. I just simply wanted to make the point to Kerry, you know, to tell him that there is abundant, solid evidence of widespread fraud of various kinds last year.
And that he actually won the 2004
election.
He won,
as far as I'm concerned.
Overwhelmingly.
Well, we're told Bush won by 51% to 48%. I think it's the other way around and possibly with a larger margin than that. You know, I mean, the fraud is staggering and the evidence is staring everybody right in the face. Anyway, let me interject here. I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. You know, as you know, my politics go back to Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine.
There you go.
And I'm frankly disgusted by how the Democrats have closed their eyes to this issue.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had this conversation. I found it very bracing. I have to say I was really up and I emailed friends. I said, oh, Kerry believes the race was stolen. Then I was started to tour with Fooled Again. And I was on Democracy Now, I guess last Friday. And
With
Amy Goodman, right? And I was debating.
Who was on this show last Friday?
Oh, good.
Enough,
good.
So, yeah.
She's terrific.
Yeah, she is.
I was debating with Mark Hertzgard, who'd written this piece in Mother Jones, trying to throw cold water on the so-called theory that the Republicans stole the election, which is another sign of how serious the problem of denial is. That a lot of
Mark Hertzgard is a progressive, is he?
He is. He's also an old friend of mine. But
so we've got a number of progressives, from talk show hosts to authors out there saying, "Ah, oh, you guys, you're it's like the JFK assassination. You're all
exactly
crazy.
Right.
You know, there's no evidence."
That's the Republican Party line. Why why is Michael Moore taking it? You know, why is Russ Baker taking it?
Yeah.
Why is Daily Kos?
So anyhow, John, you get some blowback from John Kerry's office. He says,
"Yeah, well, this is all over the internet because Democracy Now sent out a press release saying." Breaking, you know, Kerry believes race was stolen.
Right.
So Ross Story, a few hours later, called Kerry's office. Kerry's office released a statement categorically denying he'd ever had the conversation with me.
Oh, my.
I mean, not even saying, you know, it's a difference in interpretation, and accusing me of cheap sensationalism, saying, we know Mr. Miller's trying to sell a book, which really pissed me off.
Yeah.
And they said that the only true thing in my account was that I'd given him the book. So I'm telling you this story to make the point that this is not a partisan issue. You know, this is a civic issue.
Yeah.
The two parties.
This is about the future of democracy, ultimately. I mean, that's the bottom line.
The survival of American democracy. Exactly right.
And not just American democracy, Mark Crispin Miller, I have to say. Because we, I mean, you know, in 1980, what year was it? 1988, 1989, when 15,000 Chinese marched into Tiananmen Square carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché replica of the Statue of Liberty that they renamed the Goddess of Liberty. reciting Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson.
Exactly.
I mean, we literally have been, historically, until the Bush administration came along, we have been the nation that every other nation in the world has looked to and said, we want to be like them.
Exactly.
When we throw in the towel,
yeah.
Boy, every dictator and tin pot tyrant and two-bit Bush wannabe in the world, including in the developed world, including in the industrialized democracies,
right.
is going to come right after them. But by the way, I'm sure you've seen that there's today on Common Dreams, there was a news story about how there's a growing movement to impeach Tony Blair in the UK now.
All right, good,
yeah.
Good.
So
enough dictators.
Yeah, back to Fooled Again. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. He's the author of Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election, and How They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. Our phone number, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM if you want to call in. If you have a question for Mark or comment. And, Mark, how, you know, this is like with the Kennedy assassination, you know, how is it possible? You know, everybody says conspiracies, you know, by and large can't be kept. You can't keep secrets. And you couldn't have, you know, one guy, Karl Rove, in the White House manipulating hundreds of thousands of polling places. And you couldn't. And you got companies that are really more concerned about their stock price than who wins the election. And, you know, how is it possible that this election was stolen? And you point out the 2002 and the 2000 election as well. How is that possible?
Yeah, the Republicans.
I mean, it sounds like, you know, tinfoil hat stuff.
I know it does, but if you look into it, you can see that it's actually kind of comparable to the way the Klan operated during Reconstruction. You know, there was no single authority in charge of it. There was a lot of local sympathy. See, what happened.
That's how the Masons operated during the American Revolution.
Well,
you know, most of the founders were Masons.
There you go. So there's an upside to that.
Yeah.
The thing is that what happened was that there was simultaneously, you know, a very elaborate conspiracy. I mean, we have to call it what it was, directed from the White House, Karl Rove, dealing with people like Ken Blackwell in Ohio and Jan Brewer in Arizona, secretaries of state who were doubling up as chairs of the presidential campaign in those states, which should be illegal.
But do you think these guys actually said to each other, let's break the law, here's how?
Yeah, I think so.
You do?
I absolutely do think so. I think the Conyers report makes abundantly clear that Blackwell, broke the law with impunity several times.
When a reporter came to him and said, hey, aren't you, you know, there was all these news reports about Ohio was going to be the next Florida. And he said, this is before the election, aren't you concerned about being the next Catherine Harris? And he said, with a smile, look what happened to her. And, of course, she got a seat in Congress as a result of her service to the party and country.
Her shamelessness is amazing.
Yeah.
But we have to understand that while this was going on up at the top, there was a lot of freelance participation at the grassroots level by theocratic activists, many of whom were working in polling places, who were interfering really energetically with the right to vote on the part of people whom they regard as demons. I mean, we have to understand. See, Fooled Again isn't just a catalog of all the crimes and improprieties. It is that. And it gives a panoramic sense of what went down. It also describes the theocratic mentality that drove the anti-democratic effort. This is a movement that is profoundly hostile to the Enlightenment.
Which is what birthed American democracy.
Precisely.
The Enlightenment of the 17th century.
Deeply un-American. That's why we have to look into it.
Yeah. Anti Descartes, anti Rousseau,
anti-rational.
Anti-Locke, anti-rational. Absolutely. The book is Fooled Again. Mark Crispin Miller is with us. The subtitle, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. I'd like you to give me, Mark, when we come back from this break that we're going to have to go into in just a second here, I'd like you to give me a couple of specific examples, nice, tight, clear, like talking point kind of things that people can say to their friends when their friends are around the water cooler, you know, they're at the office and the guy says, oh, come on, give me a break. You can't say, and you know, the one sentence, oh, here, did you know this? Oh, here, did you know this? Give me a couple of these after we come back. And then we've got a bunch of callers who want to talk with you as well.
Excellent.
Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, the author of Fooled Again. It's on the bookstore in your bookstores now and available online as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be.
And when are the working class heroes going to stand up and say, no, we want our votes counted, damn it! We want our votes counted! 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. We have Mark Crispin Miller in the studio with us. We're talking about the theft of the election in 2004. Mark, let's take a... Oh, I asked you before the break.
Bullet points.
Bullet points. Yeah.
Okay.
Toss a few at me.
Sure thing. And there's just a wealth of examples to choose from. I'll just give you a couple. In about 11 states, the touchscreen voting machines would systematically turn Kerry votes into Bush votes. I mean, we know this happened in Ohio, but it happened all over the country.
How do you know this happened?
Because of, widespread reports. People who are interested in firsthand accounts should go to the website EIRS, Election Incident Reporting System. You type EIRS and then the name of a county or the name of a city, and you get a log of all the complaints that were successfully phoned in about what was going down. And that's just...
Now, is this a government agency?
No.
Is it a bunch of hippie, liberal, lefto pinkies?
Frankly, I don't know what it is. Very bureaucratic, nonpartisan, very straight. Nothing left about it at all.
So were there people calling in and saying, hey, I tried to vote for Bush, and the machine said Kerry?
Yes.
How many? What's the percentage?
It's impossible to say. There was just a suspiciously high number of such calls in about 11 states.
But my question is...
It never happened the other way around.
See, that was my question.
Yeah.
No, I said, were there people who tried to vote for Bush, but the machine said you voted for Kerry?
No, that
did not happen.
I don't know of any example. Maybe once or twice.
So in every case in 11 states, when people pushed the Kerry button, it would say, thank you for your vote for George Bush. But it never happened that somebody pushed the Bush button. Because they have acknowledged, the voting machine folks and secretaries of state and whatnot and the media all acknowledge that this happened.
Right.
And that these are misaligned touchscreens and these were glitches and these were software errors. But if it was really any of those three, you would expect there to be a randomness to it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the case. And there is no such randomness. The beauty of using these touchscreen machines to steal elections is it's very easy to make it look like, just an accident.
Oops.
Yeah, somebody jiggered the machine.
Yeah.
Well, these things happen. I mean, that's an argument for going back to paper ballots and banning the participation of all private vendors in our electoral system. That's one of my policy suggestions.
This is my big rant, is that, the whole point of a democracy is that we all get together and say there's this stuff called the commons, the air, the water, the police, the fire, the streets, whatever, that we collectively own.
Precisely.
The way we administer the commons is through the government, which is the largest of the commons or the power that controls the commons. And the way that we administer the government is through our vote.
So
our vote is the most sacred part of the commons. And what are they doing privatizing our vote? I mean, and they've already done it.
I know, they've done
it. There was no discussion.
80% of the votes in this country are either counted by or cast on electronic machines manufactured by Diebold, ESNS, or Sequoia, which all have strong partisan connections. I would be no happier than I am now if those were partisan connections to the Democrats. I would be just as outraged.
Yeah.
And if the Democrats had pulled this thing last year, I'd have written the same book. Let me give you another example, very different. Hmm. The overseas vote, the expatriate votes, between 4 and 7 million ballots abroad. 43% of those foreign voters, according to the Overseas Vote Foundation, never received their ballots or didn't get them in time to cast them. As I also point out in Fooled Again.
What percentage?
43%.
And these are people that the people sending out the ballots knew in advance were probably going to vote for Kerry because they tend to be more internationalized.
Precisely. More cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
People call it the 51st state. It's a constituency that skews Democratic, right? There was a big website, the FVAP, that was set up to expedite voting from abroad, registering from abroad, which had been a very, very arduous and complicated process.
Right.
It was a state-of-the-art site. All of a sudden, in late August, for 4 crucial weeks, it was blocked on the servers in 25 countries with large American populations. It was blocked in France, in Britain, in Japan, in Spain. The Pentagon's explanations were mutually contradictory. They made no sense. And the thing magically came back online, came back to those servers late September, when it was effectively too late, to get your ballots in the mail and then returned again. If stuff like this, Tom, had happened under Saddam Hussein, nobody in this country would have trouble recognizing it for what it was, right?
Right.
But it happens
here.
Or
in the Ukraine.
Or anywhere, anywhere. But it happens here, and people say, no, that wouldn't happen here. I mean, the Bush regime would do a lot of terrible things, but they wouldn't steal an election. Well, they stole the first one. You know, they stole at least three crucial Senate seats in 2002.
Which seats were? I know of Max Cleland in Georgia.
Minnesota, and Colorado.
Minnesota.
Yeah, all three states upset victories by theocratic Republicans. All three states, Diebold had a very large role to play in the election.
But you don't think that this is happening at a corporate level, do you? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the corporation, as a corporation, can't be involved in this, that you'd have perhaps employees or people who have infiltrated it, or
frankly,
you know, true believers.
Well, the management of these companies, is on record as being pro-Bush. Wally O'Dell, the CEO of Diebold, sent around this.
Yeah, but as an individual, he said, you know, we're going to.
Yeah,
I mean, he was the chairman of some county committee.
I have a feeling that these corporations are involved. I do. And that's what the evidence suggests. I don't really care. I just want them banned, right? I don't want them participating in our elections.
Now, you know, we've had corporations providing voting machines in the United States for 50 years,
right.
the lever machines, but they didn't control the software, because the lever
exactly
machines
right.
were little gears that anybody could look at.
Right.
So really, isn't it about having open source software more than banning the machines
precisely.
Themselves?
It's about making the system transparent and eliminating private vendors from it.
Right. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, our phone lines are slammed. Every single line is full. We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you. So can you stick around over the top of the hour?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll continue taking calls. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, the author of Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. Mark Crispin Miller. And we'll give you your website when we come back, too. We're running out of time here. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Show, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. You're here in the real free speech zone. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, the author of a number of books, The Bush Dyslexicon, for one, which is a brilliant insight into the life of George W. Bush, Cruel and Unusual, another. We've talked about those books in the past on this program. His new book, Fooled Again. And you got to get this book. I mean, you have to get this book. Is there a website for this book, Mark?
No, but my blog is markcrispinmiller.com.
Okay.
People can go to that and order it that way.
Yeah, and of course, all the online sellers have it. But, you know, if you possible, patronize your local bookseller. Let's take a few phone calls here. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. You're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi. A question was asked earlier in the show that I think, Tom, it was you. You know, do you think these people really decided they were going to, you know, violate the law? And I maintain that the conservatives have a long-standing policy that the end justifies the means. Example, and this is from Powell's own book, former Secretary of State, where he described meetings in which Ollie North and the rest discussed selling 4,400 TOW rockets to the terrorist state of Iran. This is the same state of Iran who blew up 227 Marines in Lebanon and killed them. And not only didn't we take any action against them, we're turning around a few years later and selling them TOW rockets.
Yeah, well, that was because they were kind enough to hold our hostages so that Reagan could beat Carter in the election. You have to keep these things in historical perspective, Phil.
My point is that
Mark, it's really not funny.
It's painful, pained laughter.
Yeah.
As well.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Mark Rich, was prosecuted for exactly the same thing that Reagan and Ollie North did.
Yeah.
And what's ironic here is the guy who is closest to the vice president, who is now indicted on a felony, was Mark Rich's attorney, who arranged for the presidential pardon.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. No, I didn't.
Yes, well, he was. He was an.
I learned something every day.
He was a high-powered attorney before, you know, while Clinton was president. He was in private practice, and Mark Rich was his client. He arranged the pardon for Mark Rich, and Mark Rich got in trouble for selling arms to Iran, exactly what Ollie North did.
Right. Amazing. Phil, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that with us. Michael in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, hi. My question is about John Kerry. And you mentioned that you spoke with him and then he wouldn't admit that you spoke with him. Now, the next morning after the election, you know, when all the troubles were coming up in Ohio, John Kerry said, "Our country is greatly divided. Now is the time to let the healing begin." But I'm sorry, throwing in the towel to George Bush is not healing my country. What do you think about John Kerry and his role in this election? Is he a part of this scam or what?
I don't think they struck a deal. I think it's a matter of his vanity and excessive cautiousness and the really stunningly idiotic advice given to him by Bob Schrum and Mary Beth Cahill, his top handlers, who have a stellar record, each of them, of losing elections. Right?
Yeah, all the way back to Dukakis.
I know. It's really quite a history. You know, Kerry was convinced that he was convinced by these people that he could not win. In the book, I describe what happened when Kerry called Edwards on the cell phone. I spoke to a relative of Edwards who was standing with him when he got the call from Kerry. And Edwards was really angry because he'd just been on TV promising to counter every vote like 4 hours earlier. Kerry, you know, said, "I'm going to concede." Edwards tried to talk him out of it. And then Kerry said, according to my source, "Listen, they're telling me up here," this was in Martha's Vineyard, "that if I don't concede, they'll call us sore losers." To which Edwards said, "So what?"
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
Is that the worst thing that could happen? Better the country should go fascist than that somebody should call you a sore loser.
Yeah.
Now, Kerry is a man excessively fixated on his own image. I think there's a lot of vanity there. I think there's a lot of short-sightedness there. But he's all too much like the people he was complaining about to me. He will not go there.
Which is tragic because he was such an extraordinary and dynamic guy back, you know, in the 70s.
Right. Well, you know, he got older. He got richer.
He got part
of the establishment.
Yeah. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. You're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Hey, what's up, Kenny?
Now I know why Bush don't take polls. He don't worry about polls because he got the elections wrapped up, huh?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, he don't worry about them things. You know, what amazes me, now they want to put these machines in my state of Maryland, which has been a blue state for a long time now. Now they want to stick these machines over here. And it seemed like it's this runaway freight train and nobody's trying to stop it. And I'm glad that you wrote this book about it.
Thank you. No, that's...
Go ahead.
Yeah. You're absolutely right about Maryland. There's a big push to get these machines into every Democratic stronghold. I'm from New York. They're trying to get the machines into New York. I lived in Maryland for 15 years, and I know your Governor Ehrlich really wants to get those machines in there. There's a move to get them into Illinois. There's always a move to get them into California, although it's been halted twice. It's not true, however, that nobody's trying to stop it, because in all these places there are local efforts to thwart these people and not allow them.
If somebody wants to join one of these local efforts, is there a central clearinghouse? Is there a central website where they can go and find this kind of information?
I don't know of one. I'm sure there may be one. But you know, if people check out Black Box Voting or U.S. Vote Counts or any of these groups, they'll probably see what we need, Tom, is to get this issue on the national radar screen so that everybody knows what happened when there's the, requisite outcry over that. I think the movement will sort itself out. I think the money will appear. I think the George Soros types out there will fund a really responsible national movement to, you know, get us back to paper ballots, ban the participation of private vendors, set up a uniform federal system, and all the other reforms we desperately need.
David in Blaine, Washington. You're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Morning, gentlemen.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, so what are the people to do about this vote fraud situation? I mean, jam the lobbies and atriums of the Congress? and have a peaceful sit-in?
Well, you know, I'm not at all averse to civil disobedience or mass action, and
That's the next level that needs to happen, because that will definitely get everybody's attention. It'll, you know, like you said, attract, you know, the money that's needed from the Soroses of our country. I mean, and the other point is, nothing more was said from the media about Schwarzenegger's little photo op last Tuesday at his polling place, as we found out that he had already voted on one of those voting machines.
Wasn't that incredible? He shows up to vote, and the voting machine says, you've already voted. And he's the governor!
Can you believe it?
And it didn't make the newspapers. Amazing thing. It was a 3-inch story that appeared for like 3 hours in the wire service. David, thank you for the call.
The subject is taboo.
Yeah, it really very much is. Carl in Monterey, California. You're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Good day, gentlemen.
Hi.
There's a quote by Stalin who said that it doesn't matter who gets the most votes. What counts is really who counts the votes.
That's absolutely accurate. That's what Stalin said, and he was right. And let me reply to that with a point I think we've made before, but it bears repeating.
Thank you, Carl.
Elections are – it is not elections that make a democracy, right? Saddam Hussein had
elections.
It's popular control of the electoral process. It's public participation in the electoral process. This process has been taken away from us. The use of these electronic touchscreen machines and this proprietary software essentially means that we have our votes counted in secret. That's not acceptable.
By private for-profit corporations.
Really?
Yes. Brant in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Brant, you're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Mark. Mark, I've read some of your other books. Can't wait to get my hands on this one.
Thank you. A
couple of quick points. First off, it's very frustrating living in Alabama. And being a blue person in a big red sea, but good news and bad news. A couple weeks ago, I was at work.
Brant, we only have about 40 seconds. I'm sorry, we've got to take a break. Can you make it a short story?
Well, yeah, just that back during the last governor's election here, the Birmingham News reported, if Mark would like to go back and resource this material, that one of the Baldwin County officials was called to the courthouse that night. I, too, went to bed thinking Don Siegelman won. And his report in the Birmingham News was that he got a call and went back to the courthouse about 3 a.m., and he found a couple of the elections officials there in a locked office doing something with the ballots. And then suddenly Raleigh gained 11,000 votes, but he went on to say that he doesn't think there was anything illegal or anything underhanded going on. And,
right. He originally started out actually protesting it, and then the next day the
found the horse's head in his bed. You know?
Yeah. Well, the horse's head was the right wing wackos on talk radio. No offense to wackos on talk radio, being one myself, but Brant, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. I'm going to take just one more segment on this, and we'll be right back. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And I ain't no communist, and I ain't no capitalist, and I ain't no socialist, and I ain't no imperialist.
Now, we're just Americans here. We would just like our country back, please. Mr. Bush, Mr. Diebold, Mr. Wally, et cetera, please, we would like our country back. Tom Hartman here. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. In just a moment, we're going to hear a report from Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. But first, just real quickly, we've got a couple more calls for Mark Crispin Miller. Gordon in Seattle, Washington. Gordon, you're live with Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, I got an idea how to legitimize the electronic voting machines and want to know what you think about it. If they could just print out 2 receipts of how you voted, one you could keep, one you could put in a box, and the exit pollers could actually see who you voted for on your receipt. And if there is a discrepancy between the exit polling and who won, then you could go back to the box and count the printed out receipts in the box.
Okay, quickly, Mark.
That's interesting. I mean, I don't think a paper trail per se is really the solution here. I mean, if we all have pieces of paper, so what? Plus, you know,
we're not all going to get together and compare.
We're not going to get together, and the machines can be programmed to give you a receipt that says one thing and it can record a different vote. So I think we do need, though, to have grassroots exit polling. We have to set that up by 2006 because we're not going to be able to reform the system by then.
Yeah.
I think exit polling is definitely the way to go.
Well said. Pat in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Pat.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
I just want to say a few things. I read Mark everywhere online, and I really appreciate his work. And, Tom, of course, I love your work.
Thank you.
And you brought a great voice for us. And I wanted to tell you that I've been calling. I've got my senator list up here, the phone list.
And great. Yeah, you can reach any senator by calling 202-225-3121, by the way.
Yeah.
So.
And I've been calling. I've got about eight called. And I called Carrie first because I was really upset when Mark mentioned that he didn't recall his conversation with him. And I don't know where the guts went in these guys, but I think this is the most important thing in our lives right now, those voting machines and the fact that they can be messed with. I read the GAO report, and I'm just going to hand my senator's list off to all my friends and see if they'll start making the same phone calls. And I don't know what else
on you,
to
Pat.
Do.
Amen.
Yeah, that's what we got to do. Pat, you're doing the right thing. Thanks so much.
That's so true. I mean, the right to vote is the linchpin of all our liberties.
Amen.
Right? This is the issue.
As Thomas Paine said, take away a man's vote, you reduce him to tyranny. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy.
Hi, guys. I wanted to ask Mark a quick question. Mark, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I just love that video, A Patriot Act.
Yes.
I watched it the day after the election. It was the only thing that made me feel good, and I don't know why it made me feel good because it was all so depressing. But you said something in that video that I wanted to ask you about. You said that the choir is big enough. We're just not angry enough. What is going to make us angry enough?
That's a great question, Amy.
I actually think we are angry enough. I think that what's happened to Bush over the last few months started happening to Bush last fall.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't this precipitous and sudden fall. You know, we voted against this guy. We didn't elect him. And when I say we, that includes a lot of authentic conservatives out there. The American people just don't go for this guy's regime. You know, his agenda's too extreme. It's un-American. So I think we're mad enough. What we have to do is acknowledge what happened last year and not give our politicians or the press a moment's peace. They have to deal with this issue.
Especially the press.
Especially the press.
You've got to get out there and lobby it. Fooled Again, the book. Mark Crispin Miller, the author. Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and How They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. Mark, thanks for being with us in the studio.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, what's up? Victoria Jones?
Of course, has a different name.
Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. What's that? We have about a minute and a half. I'm sorry to have your news report so short. We had a great guest here.
It was fascinating. The 9/11 Public Discourse Project issued its third report on foreign policy, public diplomacy, and nonproliferation. There may have been two passing grades. Everything else, we are failing grades, is what they told us.
Oh, really?
In
terms of
against extremists, some progress. Minimal progress for a coalition strategy against Islamist terrorism.
In other words, the Bush administration is not keeping us safe.
The Bush administration and Congress, both.
And Congress, yeah, and the Republican-controlled Congress.
Correct.
Tragically.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Do
you think this is going to get any play in the media, Victoria?
A little bit. They themselves made the point that there are other things going on and people aren't focused. They also made the point that there is no single more important issue than this. All the other issues fail to matter if this issue is not dealt with.
Yeah.
So I don't think it'll get
well
the attention
said.
It deserves.
Okay. And what else? We have about 45 seconds. What else is happening in the belly of the beast there in Washington, D.C. today?
The beast himself, some would say, I would never say such a thing, took off in Air Force One for Asia.
Yeah, get out of town quick. He's going over to see the people that he's borrowing $2 billion a day from, the Chinese.
Well, you want to stay on good terms with whoever you owe money to.
Yeah. Well, we definitely owe them a pile of money.
Yes.
Yeah. And so he's visiting China, Japan, South Korea, and Mongolia.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, he is. At first, the U.S. president ever to visit Mongolia. And I just hope that he doesn't have a repeat of what happened to his father in Japan. Wasn't it then that he threw up?
Yes. Yeah, yes. He was taking Halcyon, the benzodiazepine sleep drug, that was the excuse. We'll see. And maybe he's going to Mongolia because they've discovered a new source of cheap labor there for Walmart. What do you think? A new country we can exploit. Amazing. Victoria Jones, thanks so much.
Thank you.
TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks for being with us today. Good talking with you. Oh, my goodness, my goodness. It's 27 and a half minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
And welcome back, my friends.
Did you watch the Sunshine State? How the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate? Jeb Bush winked, I told you so.
Indeed. Welcome back. 34 and a half minutes, 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Speaking of sanity, Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, is with us.
Hi, Tom.
One of the more... Hey, Jeffrey. Good to have you with us again. You're writing in your blog, frameshopisopen.com, today about the A or B frame. Choose A or B. What do you mean by that?
The big subject matter that's being talked about this week is Iraq. There's been a big effort by both the Democrats and the Republicans to frame the debate on Iraq to their advantage. And one of the things that I'm pushing for on my website is moral clarity in the Democratic position. The Democrats this week were really very effective at using a lot of the big players on the Democratic team to frame the subject in terms of mistakes that Democrats made when they voted for the Iraq War resolution because of misleading information that the president and the White House team put out there. But once they put out that idea, what they then fall back into is a very vague set of policy proposals about what we should do to improve the mission in Iraq. And the frame, the choose A or B frame, is my way of saying, look, we need to start from square one. We need to ask the American people a very basic question: is America better off with troops in Iraq or not? And the majority of the American people right now believe that it's time to bring the soldiers home. So the Democrats should stand up and they should say that. It's time to bring the soldiers home, and then they should.
But there's really two frames for that frame, Jeffrey Feldman, aren't there? I mean, isn't there the, is America better off in terms of our own selfish interests, in quotes, that is to say, we don't want any more of our soldiers killed, versus is America better off, which you can make an argument for, by the way, versus the argument of we're better off with our soldiers not being in Iraq because our soldiers have actually become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. We've become an irritant, and just as Hosni Mubarak predicted, and just as King Abdullah predicted before we invaded, we would become the problem in Iraq.
Yeah,
and I hear, you know, I hear people playing more to the former frame than to the latter frame, and I think the latter frame has more juice because it's true and it doesn't sound selfish.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Our soldiers who are incredibly idealistic and hardworking and doing the best that they can have been put into a trap by the White House policy. And the trap is that the Iraqis seem to need them to get certain things done over there, but they also don't want them there. So they're really stuck, and they've become part of the problem, and the mission is never going to be righted until they are brought back. The Democrats are, they're divided on this. There are two positions that were put out this week, two attempts to frame it. On the one hand, there's John Edwards, who published this amazing essay in the Washington Post in which he said that he made a mistake in his vote and then put forward some proposals that involved winding down the American presence.
Now, as far as I know, John Edwards is the only Democratic politician, or politician period in the United States, who's actually come out and essentially apologized for his vote.
He seems to be the most high-profile one who apologized for it. Now, there is somebody else, Russ Feingold, who doesn't need to apologize for his vote because he didn't vote in favor of the resolution. But
right.
Feingold has always been pushing also the notion of removing the troops from Iraq for very similar reasons that you just pointed out.
Yeah, that their being there is not only not helping the situation, it's making the situation worse day by day by day.
They are the problem. And what the Republicans are doing, what Bush is doing, and Cheney's team, is they are saying, look, the problem is there's problems in Iraq, but the way we're going to fix it is through torture and dungeons on the one hand, which has people outraged both over here and over there. And on the other hand, propaganda. They hire Karen Hughes and send her over there to write campaign-style speeches in order to convince the Iraqis that they really do like Americans over there when they know that they don't.
It seems, we're talking with Jeffrey Feldman of FrameShopIsOpen.com. It seems, Jeffrey, that those are basically the only two tricks that they have in their bag of tricks. I mean, that's what they do here in the United States, essentially, is, you know, the Patriot Act. Let's drag out the dungeons. Let's scare the bejesus out of people. And that's basically the only two tricks they have.
Yeah, that is the other trick. I mean, what they haven't done so far to the Iraqis, which is what they pulled out full force this weekend, is attack the Iraqi press. This weekend, for example, on Meet the Press, Ken Melman gave an interview in which he accused just about everybody in the press of being deceptive. And then on the White House website, of all places, there is a point-by-point rebuttal to a critique of the administration by two columnists for the Washington Post, Dana Milbank and Walter Pincus. I've never before seen on a government website the executive branch attempting to counter-argue a Washington Post columnist. So what their plan is to basically, rather than admit that they've done anything wrong, they're going to accuse every single person in the United States of being un-American and undermining the troops, and meanwhile not change course at all in Iraq.
Now, you said that they haven't yet attacked the Iraqi press yet. I know a number of Iraqi journalists have been killed. I don't know if you saw the movie Control Room about Al Jazeera.
I did not see that yet.
Oh, it's go out of your way. I mean, I think now you'd have to rent it or buy it, but it's one of those mind-boggling, you're never the same after you see it experiences. And it's about Al Jazeera and the war coverage in Iraq. But in any case, the Bush administration actually has shut down a number of newspapers. Remember they shut down Sadr's newspaper and it brought his people into the streets.
That's right.
So there have been some attacks on the press in Iraq. And now, ever since John Negroponte went over there, he's not there any longer, but ever since he went over there, I mean, you know, within days of his appearing there, just like as happened in Honduras, death squads emerged and people started showing up with bullet holes in their heads and their hands tied behind their backs. And a lot of those people seem to be associated with the anti-American press.
It's incredible. One of the things that actually was quite good to see this week was Howard Dean, who was also on Meet the Press, and he used this concept of the Bush administration misleading the American public. And when the Bush team were basically, they were hit by two punches. On the one hand, you had people like Edwards saying that they had made a mistake as a result of being misled, and then the head of the party, the Democratic Party, standing up and saying that they are continuing to mislead the American people. And it's really sent the White House into a tailspin of attempting to justify and continuing to deny what they're doing. And they're running out of places to hide. They're running out of people to accuse. And still, they're not thinking outside of the box.
Yeah. Zozak, by the way, in our chat room says Control Room's available on DVD at video stores, just as an FYI, and for our listeners as well. Jeffrey Feldman, FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, one of the things that I really appreciate about your website is that not only do you, virtually on a daily basis, I mean, at least with incredible regularity, whenever the Republicans trot out some new frame that has been clearly, well thought out and focus group tested by their various advisors and whatnot, not only do you expose their frame, but you always, or it's nearly always, it seems to me anyway, offer a frame to the Democrats to counter that frame. You say, you know, and here's how the Democrats should respond. Are you noticing that the Democrats are paying attention to your suggestions? Are they starting to use framing in a coherent and functional way, or are they still kind of blundering along?
I think it's a divided house on framing in the Democratic Party right now. And initially, about 6 months ago, there was a lot of excitement about framing, and the Republicans seem to have responded that there was too much emphasis on PR and communication. Ironically, that was a bullet that seems to have struck some people in the Democratic Party. So while there is a concern for consistent message, there also seems to be a lot of caution in the Democratic Party for showing the American people that a message has been worked on to be unified. That much being
said, it doesn't bother them that the Republicans are quite upfront that Frank Luntz is like their big PR guy and he's doing all this framing stuff?
I think that what the Dems are doing, rather than being upfront the way the Republicans are, is they've formed what they call a war room. And Harry Reid has been really effective at being unified. And this past week, where you have Edwards and Reid and Obama and even Biden and Dean all saying the same thing, demonstrates that even though they're reluctant to talk about framing, they're involved.
Yeah. Now, what are the frames that you see emerging from the Republican Party now? You just said that, you know, with regard to this, you know, we didn't lie, that frame is falling apart. The Democrats all saw the same intelligence, that frame is falling apart. You know, a whole series of their frames are disintegrating, and you said that, you know, they're left with essentially nothing. What are they going to pull out of the bag of tricks next?
Well, what they seem to have pulled out is this, something that I'm about to write about tomorrow, what seems to be, using this word same, the same frame. A lot of people are trying to convince the American public that the Democrats and the Republicans looked at the same documents, the same information, and they came to the same conclusions as the president. Therefore, they're not, they have to disqualify their critiques of the president. This is being repeated over and over again in a variety of ways. The Democrats looked at the same documents. They had the same documents in their hands. And the White House is really pushing this very, very hard. They seem to think that if they can convince everybody that there is no backstage to the White House, so there is no information that only the president sees, that they can get out from underneath or dodge this.
So the Democrats need to get out ahead of this thing. They need to be out there telling people how the White House, the executive branch, is the branch that controls intelligence, and then they hand the intelligence off to the legislative branch, and that, in fact, the information that the president sees is quite different from the information that the Congress sees.
Absolutely, and the Democrats need to even go farther than that. They need to take the lead now and seize the initiative on talking about what should happen in Iraq for the next 6 to 12 months. Russ Feingold just put an essay on the Daily Coast today outlining a timetable, and the Democrats need to start talking about winding down in Iraq.
Well said. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you, as always. Frameshopisopen.com. Great website. Check it out. Be sure and check it out. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. 45 minutes past the hour.
Reach the ordinarily neglected movie lover. Go to AirAmericaRadio.com now, click on the Film Movement banner, and get your Film Movement discount now. Hurry, supplies are limited.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for all of us. Fair and, well, slightly unbalanced. Speaking of slightly unbalanced, there's a story traveling around the internet, and I, you know, usually I don't share things with you that I can't double and triple source, and on those rare occasions when I do share something with you I can't double and triple source, I tell you. So I'm telling you right up front, I have not been able to get any corroboration of this. It's not, you know, coming out of a totally not credible source. I mean, you know, it's not coming out of the LaRouche campaign or something like that. Not to say that they're totally not credible. Please don't send me all the LaRouche's 5,000 emails. But, you know, in other words, it's not somebody who's got an axe to grind. But this story that the one of the reasons why, we report, you decide. I'm just going to toss this out, and you can make up your own mind on this. Brewster Jennings was the phony front CIA company that Valerie Plame was the head of. Brewster Jennings was the name of the company. And what Brewster Jennings did, Brewster Jennings was part of the non-proliferation division of the CIA, the counter-proliferation division. Their job was to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And the way that they did it was by infiltrating organizations and networks around the world that bought and sold chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. And this is why it was, you know, such a big deal that the Brewster Jennings got brought down. When Valerie Plame's name got put out there. You know, the whole thing crashed. And we don't know to this day, because the White House won't tell us, because the executive branch, the White House, controls the intelligence service of this country. And they say, well, it's a secret. We don't know to this day how many people died as a result of the outing of Valerie Plame. We don't know what intelligence operations were brought down. We don't know what was compromised altogether. We do know that in the past, when large multinational, that is, in, you know, operating in a number of different nations, large multinational CIA front organizations have been exposed. You know, the exposure back, you know, long ago, Philippa G and that whole thing, that when that happens, people die. That every, you know, as CIA agents have noted, Larry Johnson on this program, to, among others, have noted CIA operatives who said, you know, once Valerie Plame's name went out there, everybody that she ever had contact with in any foreign country, their life was at risk. We don't know how many of those people were killed. But in any case, here's the, this is the interesting story, was that in, and as I said, this is unsubstantiated as of this point in time, that in November of 2002, there was an operation to ship VX nerve gas from Turkey into Iraq. Now, this was to be placed in Iraq so that after the invasion, it could be found, so that George Bush would have proof, just in case Saddam actually didn't have anything, because the guys in the White House, they had to be, you know, I mean, what, they, you know, they're not dummies. They were listening to what Hans Blix was saying. Hans Blix saying, hey, there's nothing there. Mohammed al-Baradei, I can't find anything. You know, their best intelligence, there's nothing there. So apparently, this is the report, that there was this shipment of VX nerve gas that was going to go into Turkey, from Turkey into Iraq in November 2002, and that it was identified and stopped by the CIA through their front company, Brewster Jennings, which had been contacted to have something to do with either acquiring it or transporting it. In other words, Valerie Plame's company had something to do with preventing the White House from planting weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And this is the thing that's really bothered me all this time. LBJ did something not that different from what George W. Bush did, you know, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Hey, we've got a phony, attack here. Let's use this as an excuse for a war. McKinley did the same thing with, you know, remember the Maine, or the USS Maine, the boiler blew up. And he said, oh, we've been attacked by the Spanish in the Philippines. Start the Spanish-American War. And, you know, it made him very popular for a while. It wasn't until much later we discovered, you know, there was no there. Same with LBJ. Well, LBJ was able to keep that a secret for a long time, and he was able to essentially plant provocations. And there was certainly no shortage of real communists in Vietnam. But there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I've been asking myself, you know, why didn't we put some there? I mean, George Bush certainly has the moral capacity, I would say, I would think, to do that, to cover his own butt. Well, it looks like, actually, he tried to do that, and it was shut down by Brewster Jennings. So it could be that exposing Valerie Plame, this is the new conspiracy theory du jour, and as I said, I'm not vouching for this. I'm telling you, this is the conspiracy theory of the week, that Valerie Plame and Brewster Jennings, the company that she ran for the CIA, and the CIA shut down an operation to import VX nerve gas into Iraq in November 2002, thinking that they were stopping Saddam from acquiring weapons of mass destruction, when in fact what they were doing was stopping the White House from planting stuff that could be later found after the invasion so they could say, ha, see, here, look at this. It's interesting. I don't know. You know, this is called a salting operation by the Bush White House. And, in fact, by the way, just as an interesting anecdote, the first shipment of VX nerve gas to Saddam Hussein was in 1988. It came from a company, a U.S. company, the Carlyle Group, headed up by, in part, a little later on, George Herbert Walker Bush. Interesting. Kind of, you know, what goes around comes around and all that. So anyway, we'll see. We'll see where that goes. You know, it may be one of those stories that just kind of peters out and dies, or it may be something that'll pop up in the Washington Post next week. But we'll see. Well, that, your phone calls, we're going to have coming up with us the best of the rest of the news segment. Francis Moore-LaPaya is going to be with us. A lot coming. So stick around. It's 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy. What a radical idea to the United States of America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Tahoe Kevin in the chat room. Blair, toast or is it crumpets, he says. Might be impeachment, Kevin. It might be impeachment. They're actually talking about impeaching Tony Blair in the United Kingdom. And it looks like it's a movement that may be gathering some steam. It'll be coming out of Parliament, not out of the people. But in any case, which reminds us about democracy, which reminds us of Francis Moore LePay's new book, Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life. Francis, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Really glad to have you here. It was nice meeting you at the Bioneers Conference, in fact.
Likewise.
And your book, Democracy's Edge, first of all, before we get into some of the specifics of this, you suggest that what has happened in the United States in the relatively recent past, and I'd like to get your definition of what that is that democracy has become thin,
mm-hmm.
rather than deep. What do you mean by that?
Well, thin democracy is, and interviewer just said I should call it thin ice democracy, so maybe I should take his advice, because I'm suggesting that it is very weak and dangerous. Thin democracy is the simple notion that I grew up with in the 50s in Fort Worth, Texas, that we had democracy. We inherited it. It is simply going to the polls, optionally, you know, elections, and a market economy. And if we had those things, that was democracy, and we were home free. And it has taken me many decades to learn that that is not enough to protect us. In fact, those assumptions blind us to the fundamental tension here, that a democracy, the premise of it, is the widest possible dispersion of power so that we can have fairness and opportunity, whereas a market economy driven by the single rule of highest return to existing wealth concentrates power. So there's a fundamental
tension. So it's anti-democratic.
Yes, fundamentally anti-democratic, and can only be made democratic through our initiative. So really, democracy depends on us. A functional market depends on our making the rules so that it remains open and not concentrated and infecting our political system. So it's, you know, I thought that I was born into a democracy and realized that it's not, it's what we make. Democracy is what you and I create together, and it's not just a structure that we inherit. And fortunately, getting involved in that process is very life-giving. I don't want to make it sound like some duty that is a burden. It is the good life, as I hope my book represents, with all these wonderful people's voices in it.
Well, and as a matter of fact, what I like about your book is most books about democracy tend to be either historical, academic, sometimes rather thick and dense and hard to read, or extremely, eclectic or didactic on the one hand, or on the other hand, tend to be kind of, I don't want to say new agey, but over-idealizing and everything will be fine if we just show up kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And in a way, really, you know, yeah, everything will be fine if we just show up. But what does that mean, right?
Right. And how do we show up? And
there you go.
Those things that I argue in this book, that democracy is an art that we learn just like we learn to ride a tricycle, a bicycle, or play the piano. And we are learning. There are a lot of people who are learning this art, and we
right.
can join them. We can become one of those artists. And so it's a whole different frame for thinking about our lives and where we are on the planet that has changed my life once I began to put on this set of lenses.
Right. So in the 5 minutes or so we have left before we have to take a break and wrap this up, let me just toss out a few of your you know, you've kind of got your it's worse than you think, it's better than you think. And I'll toss out the it's worse than you think, and you tell me, you know, what we can do about that and you know, what this really means. With regard to politics, for example, just the, you know, the bottom line, I mean, politics at the base of everything. You note only 3% of Americans lend their hand to a political party, and the only values-led vocal citizens are the fringe folks regarding, for example, abortion, gay marriage. There's this red versus blue, seemingly insurmountable divide, and national gridlock. That's the meme that's out there in the press.
It is. Well, I think the most powerful for me realization is that, in fact, the majority of people who are engaged out there in their communities from a faith orientation, from their fundamental core values, through their congregations in large part, they are addressing these basic questions of democracy, of basic fairness. In other words, there are 3 million Americans engaged through networks like the Industrial Areas Foundation that operates in 60 cities, represents dozens and dozens of congregations and synagogues and other institutions, and they are tackling core questions like the minimum wage that has now hit a 56-year low relative to the average wage. They are addressing that through living wage campaigns, drawing people in who've never been engaged before. So when we think of faith-based activism, let's not buy the media stereotype, and let's recognize that this religious motivation is calling people to address the fundamental inequity that is a given in our current thin democracy.
And yet, Pat Robertson claims that 36 million people watch his show every day, and Jerry Falwell claims millions of members. You know, is 3 million people who are involved in, shall we say, progressive faith-based programs going to be enough?
Well, I think if you're talking about who's actually working in their communities, that my hunch is, and we don't, of course, know the real numbers to compare, but people who are actively engaged in joining these core questions, that those who are engaged in these issues around democratic fairness are, I cannot prove they're the majority, but they're certainly a lot more than the average American imagines.
And I think
I'm very heartened by...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it seems that the important point that you're making here is not so much that maybe we're in the majority, but that we're moving in the right direction.
Yes, and they are learning what, you know, what I've called the arts of democracy and training. One of the most impressive things is how people are going through the process of really understanding the whole idea that we create power together. It's not just about protesting what's wrong. It's about saying, I want to be accountable to help come up with solutions. So I tell stories in the book about one of the examples that has come out of this faith-based network is a whole job training plan that, you know, the job training programs have typically failed, that those that the quote-unquote experts have put together, where in South Texas, these ordinary folk put together a job training program that has, once people go through it, has tripled their income and has become a national model. So it's not just people who are out there protesting what they don't like. It's about citizens coming in with the fresh eyes and energy and experience and devising solutions that work.
Okay. With regard to economics, the top 1% of American households own more wealth than the bottom 95% combined. You mentioned the minimum wage. These are serious problems, aren't they?
Yes, and I think that the living wage campaigns are among the initiatives that have astonished me at their success. And again, you know, because they are involving people often coming from a faith orientation. These are fundamental questions of values, and also involving organizations. Another organization that comes up in a number of places in my book is, I think, still largely invisible to most folks, is 175,000 people participate in ACORN, and one of the issues that they've taken on is this fundamental fairness of how the national government has let the minimum wage sink. But in addition, through the book, I talk about the fact that so much of that concentrated wealth is because we assume that the market can only be driven by a single driver, a single value, and that is highest return to existing wealth. So people are also challenging that fundamental notion. In fact, over 90% of Americans think that corporations should be responsible to more than simply their economic bottom line.
In the bottom line, going back to the 19th century then, when a corporation's first article, the first statement in its articles of incorporation had to be, this corporation is incorporated for the purpose of serving the public good.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
returning back to this. So, we have two communities here in Portland, Oregon that are trying to fight off of Walmart. They're having to resort to zoning issues and traffic because they can't really talk about the real issue that they're worried about, which is it's going to devastate all those small local businesses. You think you're seeing a change. You're seeing forward motion.
Yes, I think we're moving in two directions at once, and therefore we can choose which
And your book is a great resource for that. Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life, an inspiring book. Lots of great stories. Frances Moore LePay, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for what you do, Tom.
Thanks, Frances. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I ain't looking to compete with you. Feet are cheap.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're tuning in, and it's as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program. Indeed. Glad to have you with us. Oh, my goodness, it must be time for a conservative alert. Yes, indeed. Fox News' Charlie Gibson brushes off Bill O'Reilly's remark that folks in San Francisco should just be bombed by Al-Qaeda. I'm sure that's not what he meant. John Gibson, I can't imagine Bill meant that. He goes to San Francisco all the time. He does shows from there. He has a good time there. I know he loves the city. I'm not sure that's not what he meant. O'Reilly's response, quote, what I said isn't controversial, what I said needed to be said, end quote. Sorry, Charlie. Charlie also said about Pat Robertson, I think what he said was, when disaster strikes, you don't turn to God, ask your Darwinians for help. The point is, Gibson says, Pat says a lot of things, and that's Pat Robertson. You talk to him about why he said a certain thing. I think that a lot of this comes from, especially this declaring ordinary signs of the Christmas season to be religious symbols and there to be out of the public view, is animosity towards Christians because of political considerations. Oh, yes. Fox News trying to politicize religion. What a surprise. Our number 1-866-440-8466. And Bill in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
I just wanted to make a comment about something you said at the top of your show about what Bush said on Veterans Day. And there was an editorial in the Seattle PI here, which is normally a pretty good paper, that really got my blood boiling. This guy wrote in and said he gave some statistics from the Civil War, the Vietnam War, World War II, saying that, you know, compared to those wars, the lives we've lost in Iraq are pretty much what he said was they're statistically insignificant. And, I was just thinking about how that must have made the families and friends of the veterans of, the 2,000-plus people that have died in Iraq feel that, you know,
well, not to mention the 16, 17, 18,000-plus people who are missing arms, legs, eyes, ears.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then
yeah.
His last statement was really idiotic. He said the reason we lost the conflict in Vietnam was due to the treasonous activities of the peaceniks in those days. And so I thought back to my dad was a World War II veteran. We lived in a small town in New Mexico, and, you know, he was pretty... You know, I don't want to say redneck, but he was a country boy, and, you know, he when all these kids from Vietnam came home in boxes, and he even said, gee, this is not the right thing to be doing, you know. And,
yeah. I mean, the bottom line is the reason we lost the war in Vietnam is the same reason the British lost the war here in 1776. You can't win a war against a popular insurgency in its own country.
Yeah.
Now, it just doesn't happen. And not when the government has the support of the people. It just doesn't happen. I mean, Hitler, by the time, by the last few years of the war with Hitler, he did not have the support of the German people. They all realized that he had gone stark raving nuts. Not all of them, but many of them, and people knew something's not right here. Something's very, very wrong here, in fact. And the same thing was happening in Japan. They just needed us to help, overthrow the leadership and awaken them from a cult. But that's certainly not what has happened in Iraq. It's not what happened in Vietnam. And for him to say that the casualties are statistically insignificant would be the same thing as saying, you can flip this around, as saying, oh, well, we only lost 3,000 people in the Twin Towers, more or less 3,000 people.
Exactly.
We lose 50,000 people a year to drunk drivers.
Yeah.
So I guess that was statistically insignificant. Therefore, why bother going to war?
Yeah.
It's just nuts. Bill, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Jim on the line. Jim, I don't have a city here for you. Where are you calling from?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Ah, great. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Thank you very much for your hard work. The reason I'm calling today is tomorrow at the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, they're going to entertain an extradition treaty. It's 108-23. It's a U.S.-UK extradition treaty. This was written and introduced in March of 2003 by John Ashcroft. And it's an absolutely terrible piece of legislation, and it ruins our Constitution. The main problem with it is it takes extradition out of the judiciary and puts it in the executive.
So
that's a biggie. And if someone wanted you extradited from the UK, you wouldn't be able to get a lawyer and fight or show that it was a wrong extradition request. It would simply be somebody in the executive branch that would say, "Yeah, I think it's pretty good."
That's a reversal of 400 or 500 years law all around the world.
Absolutely amazing.
So
that due process, they can ask that you be detained for 60 days while they prepare extradition request. That's another part of it. Then if they determine that you've made money or something, they can confiscate your goods.
Amazing. The phone number for Congress, 202-225-3121. Call your senator and let him know your opposition to. What was the bill number again, Jim?
It's treaty number 108-23. Lugar is the chairman and Biden is the ranking member.
Great.
Your senator should influence it. Thank you very much. This is a
terrible piece. Yeah, it is. Jim, thanks a lot for the call and for the information, for sharing that with our listeners. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me, can't get fooled again.
People think I'm a moron. What if they only knew the depth of my evil genius? And I can be stupid whenever I need to, yeah. In my midnight confessions.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Time for our best of the rest of the news segment. Once a week, we take a look at what's happened in the last week, what's happening in the next week, and what's the frame on the news. Arlie Shard is with us. Arlie is before he founded the Environmental Media Services in 1993, he served as a national press secretary for Al Gore's 87-88 presidential campaign, executive director of the Environmental Defense Fund. Covered politics and civil rights for 8 years for Time magazine. He's now the president of EMS, Environmental Media Services, the website, where to go, EMS.org. There you go. And Jameson Foster, is with us. Jameson Foster is a senior advisor at Media Matters for America, one of the just absolutely great websites to push back against the right-wing takeover of the media, the play and the ref strategy that's being done so effectively by the right for so many years that you know, kind of the flip side of this. And Jameson, you guys are just marvelous over at MediaMatters.org.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Actually, it's Fozer, by the way.
Fozer?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Okay. I've got a typo here.
No problem.
I appreciate that. So let me start out with you, Jameson, Fozer, Senior Advisor at Media Matters for America. What are you seeing as the major stories from last week that, you know, a couple of years from now, when we look back on this period in time, we're going to say, you know, that was it. That was a turning point. That was a major story. That was really the story of that era or that time.
Well, the big thing last week, and I think it'll continue this week, obviously, is the claim that President Bush and his allies have been making in defense of their own conduct that members of Congress saw the same pre-war intelligence that they saw, and that investigations have shown that they didn't manipulate pre-war intelligence. That's been repeated not only by Bush and his allies and his defenders, but it has been repeated throughout the media a great deal in the last several days. Some stories, like the Washington Post on Saturday, that debunked these notwithstanding, it's still something you hear all the time on television and see in newspapers, and it's just flatly not true. And so that's, in sort of our world, the big thing that's going on right now is this kind of fight over who knew what when and who had access to what when. And like I said, though, we have seen some very good news reports, like a Washington Post article debunking those claims. You know, they still show up everywhere, and the talking points get repeated by, you know, hosts on Fox and people on CNN who are interviewing guests.
Yeah, and they're never challenged. It's the amazing thing. Jameson, they are rarely challenged anyway. Jameson, one of the things that I find fascinating is that on the WhiteHouse.gov website right now, the official government paid for, your tax dollars and mine, the official website of the executive branch of government, actually an old friend of mine helped develop that website when he worked in the Clinton White House. On that website, there is a point-by-point rebuttal of the Washington Post article over the weekend that dissected Bush's arguments, or the arguments of the right, that the Democrats had the same information. This is mind-boggling.
It really is. You know, on one level, it's astonishing to me that anybody would believe the most basic of these claims, that Democrats had the same intelligence that the White House had, and that, you know, that would get repeated so much in the media. I mean, I don't imagine that anybody could possibly believe that the President of the United States doesn't have any more access to intelligence than, you know, a freshman congressman. That's obviously absurd on the face of it, and yet that's the claim that's being made.
And yet, you know, these conservatives are Republicans by and large. Actually, they're conservative Democrats, and they're actually, it wouldn't surprise me to hear Joe Lieberman say this also. But anyhow, these guys, they go on these talking head shows and they make these claims, and nobody says, "Come on, give me a break."
Sure, and you have a situation where, you know, several of the nation's leading news organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post included, have basically over the last few years apologized for the horrible job they did in covering the run-up to the Iraq War and said they weren't critical enough of Bush administration statements. Those apologies are great. They have a chance to correct that now, and yeah. It's not enough just to write one article saying the Bush administration is being misleading in these claims. Every time that Bush or one of his surrogates is quoted making a claim like this, the news organizations quoting them have a responsibility to include a rebuttal and say, you know, wait a second, this isn't true.
Except that the White House says they're editorializing now.
Pointing out facts.
Calling us on our lies is editorializing. It's not reporting. You're supposed to just report our lies.
Sure. Pointing out facts, apparently, unfortunately, a lot of news organizations have come to that conclusion that if Bush says X and X is false, they can't point that out. It would be unfair.
Yeah, their job is to simply report that Bush said X. It's amazing. It never would have happened 30 years ago. You know, Kennedy or Nixon never could have gotten away with this kind of stuff. Arlie Shart of the Environmental News Service, Environmental Media Service, rather. Hey, Arlie, how you doing today?
Fine. Just wanted to applaud your previous guest for the great work that they do.
Jameson Fozer with Media Matters for America. Yeah, both of you guys are doing great work, and I'm glad to have you both on here at the same time and talking about
Pleasure.
These things. I'm wondering, Arlie, what do you see as the biggest stories? I realize your perspective is more environmental, but the EMS is really a service for the media.
That
that's
to,
true.
To get,
and Jameson
to get information
probably,
about the environment.
Yeah, I think Jameson hit the nail on what may be the biggest story from last week, although the elections were kind of an encouraging twist last week also. But another big thing that happened last week that really does have enormous implications for the future of the country and the world is the fact that there's a big fight in the Congress right now, as you've probably read about the budget, and the Republicans have been trying to push through a budget that would cut a tremendous number of programs for the poorest of our people in this country, and it would also have a terrible impact on the environment and under the false banner of getting of reducing dependence on foreign oil and gas imports. They included in the budget bill provision to drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. But miraculously, and the reason they put it in there, by the way, it has no business being in there, but they know that they couldn't pass a drilling measure in Alaska on its own, so they wrapped it into the budget because the budget can't be filibustered, whereas a standalone legislative initiative on along the lines of the ANWR provision could be filibustered. But anyway, even with that, last Wednesday night, the Republicans had to pull out the ANWR, the Alaska provision, Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, and people call it ANWR. They had to pull it out of the budget bill because about 25 moderate Republicans finally rebelled, which I think was probably helped by, again, by the election results showing a little bit of a tendency toward more moderation. So
yeah, it's
right
called
now,
2006 is coming.
Exactly.
What's going on, right?
But the, this is just emblematic of what the Congress has done throughout the last at least 5 years of the Bush administration, which is they will do nothing at all for energy conservation, and then they make up these silly ideas that drilling in ANWR is going to relieve us of dependence on foreign oil. They haven't done a thing about reducing mileage standards for cars, or rather improving mileage standards for cars, or anything about energy efficiency, or almost nothing about alternative energy, energy conservation. All those things are very, very short-term ways that we could reduce our dependence on imported oil, but they won't do a single one of those. If we drill in Alaska, if they should force this thing through after 20 or 25 years of trying to do so, the benefits would amount to about 1 penny per gallon for the average American driver about 20 to 25 years from now.
Yeah,
that oil will never get down here.
But it's going to equal billions of dollars for the oil companies, and that's what they know about. Arlie.
Well, the irony there is that the oil companies just reported profits of the top five have $100 billion in profits over just the last quarter.
Oh, I know, the largest profits
in
the 167,000-year history of the human race.
And the amazing thing is that at the same time, this same Congress gave the energy industry about, I think it's something like $14 billion in subsidies
in welfare. Arlie, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We only have a minute left, and I wanted to ask both of you if what you see is coming up. Jameson Fosler, the senior advisor at Media Matters for America. Jameson, what do you see as the big story emerging this week right now?
Well, like we talked about earlier, some of the claims about the Iraq pre-war intelligence I think are going to be big. One thing that I think eventually has to emerge is a question that the media isn't asking about Iraq. We see a lot of reports about media polls and other things that show that the American people basically don't trust Bush and think that he lied to us about Iraq. But there's a next question that hasn't been asked yet, which is how that affects the country going forward, and whether the American people have confidence in the commander-in-chief and whether they'll believe him if he should have to make the case for war again.
Yeah, which he's trying to do with Iran right now in Syria.
Sure, that's a huge elephant in the room, that if people don't trust this guy and don't trust him to tell us the truth about the need for military exercises, that makes us less safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Jameson Fosler, right?
Yes.
Senior advisor at Media Matters for America. My apologies, Jameson, for having your name wrong. MediaMatters.org, the website. And Arlie Shart, the founder and president of the Environmental Media Services, EMS.org. Thank you both for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Much appreciate it.
Take
Great
care.
Talking with both of you. You too. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, truth and common sense in broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Yeah, that's me. Hey, welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Fort Lauderdale, Florida on the line. Hey, John, welcome.
How you doing? How
I am Tom? Great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
How you doing today?
Good.
You know, since, you know, you say, what's the hottest story? Well, of course, the hottest story has been Iraq all along, and it still is, right? With our casualties every day. Well, I just wanted to hit on a few points, if I may. First of all, we have removed a ruthless dictator, that's number one. And we have removed a ruthless regime. Now,
here's a question for you, John. Why did we put that ruthless dictator and that ruthless regime there in the first place?
Well, I don't have the answer for that one. But we already
I think that anybody who wants to point out that Saddam was a ruthless dictator should point out that the United States installed him in power, and we did so for a reason, and the reason is very simple, because we thought that he would guarantee stability in the region, and it actually was relatively stable until he decided to go off half-cocked against Kuwait after, by the way, he asked April Gillespie if he could, and she told him that he could.
Right. Do you agree with this, Tom? Let me say this. We've already won because we gave him the right to the Iraqi people to choose a new leader. Now, haven't we won there?
No,
we
haven't.
We've given him that right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Try and tell, choose, right?
John, try and tell that to the average Iraqi. You know, give me a break, John. The fact of the matter is that what we have done is we have inflamed the Middle East. You just had four Iraqi suicide bombers blow themselves up in Lebanon, John. Before we showed up in Iraq, there had never in the 7,000-year history of Mesopotamia, of that area as a civilized part of the world, in the 7,000-year history of that area, there had never been a suicide bomber until we showed up.
You've never been in Iraq to begin with, is that what you're saying?
I am agreeing with King Abdullah of Jordan when he said it yesterday on television that before the invasion he told George Bush, if you do this it'll be a terrible mistake, and he still believes it was right. I am agreeing with Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, who said if you do this you will create 1,000 bin Ladens, and he was right. And I'm agreeing with the leaders of every member of the Security Council, including the democratic nations of France and Germany, who said, Germany's not in the Security Council, but in any case, the leaders of the Western world who said, hey, let's give the inspectors a little more time. Yes, I'm agreeing with Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, who both said in the first 3 months of the Bush administration, Saddam Hussein is in a box. We've got him right where we want him.
So did we go after the right people as far as the World Trade Center is concerned?
Are we in
the right places?
Obviously, you know, are you suggesting, why are you talking about 9/11 in the context of Iraq?
Well, because isn't it how this all started as far as the big fight on terrorism?
No, that's how it started with regard to the big lie, John. I'm sorry, I'm over it with you. Either John is so abysmally ignorant that he's believing the big lie that for example, Ken Melman was doing this yesterday. I mean, it was incredible. I was amazed that finally Tim Russert called him on it. Melman was saying, well, in this post-9/11 world, and finally Russert says, you know, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And Melman goes, well, but in this post-9/11 world, Iraq 9/11. Yeah, except that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. In fact, Osama bin Laden, who, by the way, the Bush administration has not caught. He's still running around loose on his cam, a 6'6" guy with a camel and a dialysis machine, and the Bush administration can't find him. Anyway, more than five dozen, speaking of Republicans, more than five dozen Republican lobbyists are named as members of the host committee for a fundraiser in Washington on Thursday to benefit House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's reelection campaign. Get this. This is going to be the largest, well, this is from the Tacoma, Washington News Tribune. The event is expected to be the largest fundraiser for a Congress member this year. Wayne Berman of the Federalist Group, a lobbying firm, said, and I quote, "This is more than just a fundraiser. It's a way of saying that an important part of the Republican establishment supports Tom DeLay and will continue to support him in the future. Yes, we stand behind our felons, or our indicted felons, our indicted potential felons." Host committee members are expected to give the maximum $2,100 personal contribution or to raise $5,000 for DeLay's reelection. And, of course, if they bring corporate money from Texas, they can also go to jail along with DeLay. In the other follies from this administration, despite a month-old pledge, FEMA has yet to reopen four of its biggest no-bid contracts for Hurricane Katrina work and won't do so until the contracts are virtually complete, reports the Associated Press. The promise to hire more minority-owned firms is also largely unfilled. The politically Republican, well-connected Shaw Group, Bechtel Corp, CH2M Hill, Inc., and Fluor Corporation received no-bid contracts worth over up to $100 million each right after Katrina. And FEMA promised this back to the AP. FEMA's promised to boost the number of contracts given to minority businesses, but in the last month that percentage has increased only slightly, from 1.5 to 1.8%, well below 5%, which is the standard for federal contracts. And the last I looked, minorities make up about, 25-30% of the population of America? In any case, FEMA's performance falls far short, says Representative Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson, the ranking Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee. He says, "I am from Mississippi, and I know sharecropping when I see it." FEMA's also been criticized for these no-bid contracts. Critics say it's a way to reward politically correct connected firms. For example, Bechtel CEO Riley Bechtel served on Bush's Export Council from 2003 to 2004. Shaw Group's lobbyist Joe Albaugh is the former FEMA director and a friend of Bush. Both companies, the Associated Press notes, have denied the political connections played a factor. Yeah. And I got a bridge to sell you. Amazing. Thanks so much for being with us today, my friends. And listening to the program, sharing it with your friends. We will see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Remember, always, always, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.